I'm a product of the Old Baptist Bible Fellowship when it still was sort of kind of in its infancy, when the emphasis back in those days was, when you get out of school, go start a church. And I know that a lot of the things that they have done and advocated has ended up in a lot of things that we would not do. For example, their position on the church, their Baptist bride position, and that sort of thing. But when we got out of school, we were told there was two big emphases: missions and go start a church. So I went out and started a church. And all of the things that Brother Murphy mentioned, which I thought were fascinating, I thought it was very, very good presentation, by the way. I didn't know how to do any of those things, and I still don't. I probably never will. But the churches that we've started, you could look up Grace Baptist Church in Rochester, Washington, and they've got a website. I started that church from nothing. You could look up Napavine Baptist Church in Napavine, Washington. They've got a working website, and I started that church from nothing. You could look up Sovereign Grace Baptist Church in Ontario, California. I started that church from nothing, and they've got a working website. You could look up Grace Baptist Church in Corona, California, that I took when it had 8 members and built a big auditorium and a large congregation, and they've got a big work site and all of that stuff. So it all works. It's all right. It's all proper. And all of those admonitions and advices that Brother Murphy gave you that I probably will never utilize, I see the practicality. I see the use of them. I see the benefit that can be derived from all of them, and they will do all of you good. And so I can't preach on those things, and I can't visit with you about those things. But I know what it's like from 50 years of practical doing. I know what it is to start a church. I know what it is to take a struggling church. I know what it is to pastor a church where the congregation is your wife and your kids, and then hopefully watch God bring the thing up. So I just want to visit with you about yourselves. I'd like you to find 1 Kings chapter 19. I just want to take as our subject text this morning probably one of the most familiar passages on the subject of discouragement or despondency or depression that you're probably most familiar with. 1 Kings chapter 19. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. Just went back home and cried his eyes out and screamed and wailed and carried on. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and withal how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. And then Jezebel sent a messenger unto Elijah, saying, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." Why, that's a death warrant. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongeth to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die, and said, "It's enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I'm not better than my fathers." I think that we see that the great men of scriptures experience their most prominent failures in those areas of their character where they seem to be the strongest. Bible says that Moses was the meekest of men, yet he spoke unadvisedly with his lips. John was the apostle of love, but he illustrates religious intolerance. You remember he wanted to call fire down from heaven and incinerate those folks just because they didn't do things his way. Peter was bold and he was outspoken, leader in many of the endeavors of the apostles. But he proved to be a coward, denying his Lord. And if you remember, he caved into the Judaizers and prompted a scathing rebuke from Paul. Now, if there's anything I think out of the ordinary about Elijah, I would suppose to say that he was not given to human weakness. He was bold. He spoke his mind. He was disciplined. He was self-controlled. He did an unthinkable act. If you remember, like John the Baptist, he dared to rebuke his sovereign. You just didn't do that in those days because there was no legislative process by which you could get protected. It was off with your head. He was like the general that burned the bridge behind him, leaving no alternative to himself but death or victory. Do you remember up there on the mountain? He taunted his adversaries, the priests of Baal, back there on Mount Carmel, making them gnash their teeth and cut themselves with knives, and all to the end of guaranteeing to himself a horrible death from his enemies if he had failed in his endeavor. If God had not answered his prayer, I guarantee you that Elijah would have been the dead man. And again, you remember in his last hour when he was on his way to a strange and unheard of departure from this world, when the whirlwind and the fire chariot were ready, he wanted no human companionship. I think even the bravest of men find sympathy if they seem to show a weakness, a chink in the armor, a human need of comfort, of understanding, somebody to hold their hand, somebody to stand with them, somebody somewhere with a tender heart that would offer help or comfort. But Elijah would have rejected every bit of that. In full keeping with the rest of his lonely, severe character, he desired to meet his Creator all alone. Now, beloved, it was that man, so stern, so iron, so independent above all human weakness, it is that man who, of whom it is recorded that in his hour of trial, he gave away to a fit of despondency, to discouragement of which there is hardly found a parallel. He was utterly cast down. So I think that our subject today of spiritual discouragement or despondency is fitting because it comes to preachers, it comes to teachers, it comes to evangelists, it comes to those men that God has called to proclaim His glorious gospel throughout this world in whatever quarter it might be. So first of all, the question comes, how come? What caused it? Well, I submit to you this morning that first of all, it was physical exhaustion. He was utterly and absolutely worn out. When he heard of Jezebel's sentence of death, he ran for his life. He spent the whole day on the move, looking backwards, skirting all of the open areas, eyes open, ears cocked for everything that might go on. He fell down, he sprained his ankle, and he finally came to a juniper tree, and he's faint, and he's hungry, and he's thirsty, and he's travel sore, and there's a just kind of a damp, heavy oriental wind blowing across his face. The prophet and the man is shot. His spirit just gives way, and he lays there and he longs to die. You simply cannot argue that at least some of the cause for his "I give up, I want to die" despondency, discouragement, is purely physical. You and I are fearfully and wonderfully made. Our mind certainly has the power over our bodies, but it's just as certain, I believe, that the body influences the mind. Small things, too much heat, too much cold, cloudy, windy day, toothache, that can make all of the difference between happy and unhappy, between faith and doubt, between faith and hesitation. We think that we're not being spiritual when something as trivial as a physical disability hinders our services. We think that we are so far above all of the merely physical that bodily disability certainly could not bear anything on our spiritual lives. And we're quick to judge somebody else when we see him slacking, and our definition of slacking because of some outward physical circumstances. We privately, all piously, we talk about God withholding his face. We talk about the fiery darts of Satan. But the fact of the matter is that our bodies are channels of sorrow every bit as they are channels for joy. The draining of physical strength certainly lowers spiritual barometry. It's just easy to criticize. It's easy to pass judgment. But you wait until you get sick or you get hurt or you get crippled and you get thrown under the bus, and you'll sing a different story about those people that you watch and used to talk about. Now again, listen to his words. He said, I only am left. There's no sympathy. There's nobody cares. There's nobody cares for me, nor for what I'm doing, nor what I'm trying to do. I want you to hear the stress on that word "only." But to me, that's kind of surprising. Elijah was not asking for sympathy in a much harder situation up on that mountain. He was almost bragging when he said, I am the simple, I am the solitary, I am the only prophet of God when I'm up against all of Baal's minions of 450 men. And here's the difference. Up on that mountain, there was a visible, physical, evident opposition that he could see and he could fight. He could get his hands on it. He could brace that thing. He could go against it. And under the tree, his manhood had nothing to contend with. Up on the mountain, up there with all of that opposition in front of him, there's a huge crowd gathered to watch. His juices are flowing. The adrenaline is up there. And he was a hero in the making. Well, to see, to die as a martyr and a grand failure, that'd be easy. But to die as a felon, to be hunted down, caught, chained like an animal, dragged back to die in front of his tormentors and pursuers, everything in all of our nature would shrink away from that. And Elijah began to understand that popularity is not love. The world will support us when we put forth a real show of strength, but those same ones will turn away when power and greatness are no longer on your side. I only am left, and they want to kill me. My ministry is shot. Nothing has come as a fruit of my efforts of my ministry. Now, that state of mind will be felt most strongly, I believe, by those who are of Elijah's personality and find themselves in those circumstances. To those who will stand apart, to those who will not ask for nor encourage sympathy, That's a penalty that they must pay. Their projects will be misunderstood. They seldom will find support for what they're doing. They're going to have to be content to be alone. Now, from the future, that is his future, from today, we look back into the greatness of his ministry, but that didn't give him any consolation whatsoever in the day that he was laying underneath that juniper tree. We're his descendants. Our respect and admiration of him and for him is the judgment of today. But to Elijah, what in the world does that matter? He's in that place where neither praise nor blame are heard. He lived and he died alone. Only one time do we hear the bitterness spoken. But what difference do our thoughts of today matter to him? When in that day his heart is absolutely full and it's aching, he wasn't thinking then about what future generations would think about him someday out in the future. A great mind like Elijah would feel his trial intensely. And I think that we, every one of us, felt the need, the longing for sympathy, for understanding. We've had our lonely hours. We've had our days of disappointment. We've had our moments of hopelessness. We have known times when our highest feelings have been misunderstood and our purest motives were met with ridicule. We've known days when our heavy secret was lying unshared like a slab of ice on our hearts. And then the Spirit gives way and our courage and our hope and our resolve vanishes. And you can probably remember the day, at least some of you, when we've wished that it was just all over, when it was done, when it was finished, that we could just lay down tired and rest like a little child from life. We've wished that the hour would come that we could just turn off the light and feel the grand rush of darkness on our spirit. But beloved, I want you to listen this morning. The final cause from our being able to get so down, the reason for our capacity to be so discouraged, listen to me, it's to make God necessary. When we get there, when we get that place when sympathy that is beyond human is needed, that's what happens. That's when we know and we need that God is necessary to us. Alone, all of the world against him, Elijah turns to God. He said, "It is enough now, O Lord." You see, as long as Elijah had a prophet's work to do, difficult though it might be, things were okay. But his job was done. Tomorrow would come and the day after would come. But what did he have to do? He was hiding. He was under a tree. He was miserable. He was shot. And the misery of having nothing to do is sometimes your own fault and sometimes some circumstances that are beyond your control. Some people, perhaps those that are single or widowed, poor, they're forced to endure lonely days and even more lonely nights and evenings. You that have felt hours like that can understand maybe some of Elijah's sadness. There are times, though, when this inactivity is without excuse. We live in an artificial time. Some people exempt themselves from work by eating bread that was earned by others. They stand in the food stamp line. They echo the surface of the thought of others as have been pleased to become reality, in fact, by the brains of other people. Are they blessed? The law of life is that we should eat as a result and the fruit of our own effort and our own sweat. And you can't break that law without a penalty. The law is its own executioner. See the man after a day or after a night of willful, wasteful indulgence, after he staggers in at 3 o'clock in the morning. See his countenance, sad and jaded and listless. See the filth and the folly that's needed to create artificial excitement, the drugs, the alcohol, the sex, the debauchery. Yet that same face, those same eyes, dull as they are, could be lighted with understanding, with intelligence, if they were energized by life, by God's Spirit, rather than Satan's devices. Think. Boredom is one of the signatures of man's immortality. It is very capacity for greatness that makes boredom miserable. If God had made us only to be insects, with no greater drive than self-preservation or the pursuit of pleasure, we might well be content to flit from sweetness to sweetness. But if a man with a soul lives only to eat and to drink and be amused, is it any wonder at all that life can be dark with depression and despondency? Why do you think it is that all of the rich and the famous of this world drink themselves to death, drug themselves to death, end up with debauchery? You think it's because they're happy? You think it's because they're satisfied? Not at all. On Carmel, it just looked like Elijah's great object would come to fruition. Baal's prophets killed. God acknowledged with a single thunderous voice from the crowd. False worship all put down. Elijah's life aim, the absolute transformation of Israel into a kingdom of God, was all but accomplished. And then, in a single day, all of that bright picture was put out. Do you remember in your ministry when it began and everything was going just exactly right and great, and then that happened? We desire success, but success rarely comes. The wisest man once wrote a time, if I remember, he said, "All is vanity." The diligent father counts up the gains that he's made. Every coin a representation of spent time and labor, and he watches an irresponsible son squander it. The lone politician who truly had his country's good at heart finds himself neglected and rewarded by defeat at the polling booth. I think how few there are that can look back on life and say that what he planned and what he hoped for came to pass. Life is filled with disappointments, and the moment when the pains are the sharpest are the moments like those of Elijah. But that's not the end of the story. The great physician has an antidote, a treatment for the patient. First, he dealt with his servant's exhaustion. He didn't scold him. He prescribed rest and nourishing meals. And it raised and revived his strength. If you remember, it enabled a 40-day journey. See, food and rest and exercise before any further dealing with the patient. Before that, Elijah's state of mind wasn't fit. He would not have submitted to reasoning. He needed to go to pastor school to have some rest, for some fellowship, and for some refreshing. Sometimes when people come to the preacher for counseling, and his counseling goes nowhere, then he can understand that in God's wisdom, when he deals with people, that there are spiritual cases that are cases for the doctor, first of all, before they're cases for the preacher. Then the Lord calmed the storm in Elijah's mind with the influence of creation itself. He commanded the hurricane to sweep across the skies. He moved the earthquake to convulse the earth. He lighted up the heavens until they were mass of seething fire and flame. And do you see that all of that was just a reflection of the emotions that were roiling in Elijah's brain? If you cut his head in half and lifted off the cap, that's what you have seen going on inside of his mind. You can use up your strength in destructive or constructive activities. You can use your powers either to build, tear down, or to build up. You can express yourself with a pounding fist or a helpful word. Either way is a release. And the Lord said, "Behold," and the prophet beheld. And the Lord said, "Elijah, look at all that stuff. That's you. Stern and wild and defiant and petulant. Your nerves are on edge and you're wound up tight." Now notice, God was not in the wind. And God wasn't in the fire. And God wasn't in the earthquake. God was showing his servant a reflection of his wild, stormy self and its character. And then came a calmer hour and a broken and a contrite heart. The prophet rose in reverence. And now there's a tenderness in him, a quietness, and his heart has been tamed. He'll now listen to a gentler influence. Now out of the violent voices of nature there comes not the stormy passions of man, but the still, small voice of the harmony and peace of God that back then and still to this very day passes beyond the understanding of man. Beloved, there are those spirits that have to go through this discipline. The storm struggle must precede the still small voice. There are those that mightily strive with God before they surrender. There are those who are filled with doubts before they rest in faith. There are hearts that must be broken in disappointment before they can rise in hope. There are those that must have every single thing taken away from them before they can be regained and restored by God. I say, blessed is the man who, when the dust settles and the smoke blows away, that you can recognize the scene and recognize God's hand in the matter and bears his head and bows his knee as Elijah did that day. There might be some man, some pastor, some brother in this house who knows what it feels like to have had every bit of the rug entirely torn from beneath your feet and you've been left with nothing. The Lord did more. He roused Elijah up. "What doest thou here, Elijah?" he said. "See, life is for doing. The life of a child of God is for noble doing. And the prophet wasn't doing. He was complaining. You can't do very much when you're hiding in a cave or feeling sorry for yourself." And that's God's great question to you this morning. What are you doing? There is work to be done. There is sin to be exposed. There are prayers to be made. There are souls to be won. All of that stuff that Brother Murphy talked about, all of that stuff needs to be done. Have events and have the tracks go out and the invitations go out and all of that sort of thing. The helpless need to be helped and the missionaries sent out and supported. Time is fleeting and eternity is forever. Our one chance, just one. What are you doing? Then God said, "Return on thy way," and that's for us today. Here's the cure for your lethargy. Here's the cure for your discouragement. Here is the cure for your despondency. Do something. Fill up those hours. Get off of the couch. Get out of the bed. Turn off of the television. Stop the constant texting with other crybabies. Don't brood on your problems. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Quit blaming other people. Lay off worrying about tomorrow. Make the best of today. Tomorrow only becomes intelligent in the light of an active today. Tomorrow is the birth. Tomorrow is the child of today. Get up and get going. And the spirit of health, the spirit of spiritual strength, it'll return. So what if you're the only one? You're not. You remember you've got the promise of him that said, "I'll never leave you and I'll never forsake you." Now listen to the assurance words of victory. It's in verse 18. God said, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him. So then, now listen, Elijah's life was not a failure after all. 7,000 had heard him preached. 7,000 had been encouraged and silently blessed his life for his example. There is no failure in God's world for those that are trying to serve. No work truly done, no word correctly spoken, no sacrifice freely made was ever made in vain. Never did the cup of cold water given for Christ's sake fail of its reward. If he takes notice of a cup of cold water, then I guarantee you he's watching you and making sure of what you're doing every single day. But beloved, oh, beloved, there was a darker hour and a more excruciating agony. If failure ever seemed to rest on a noble life, it was when the Son of God, deserted by his friends, heard the cry which said that the Pharisees had successfully drawn the net around their victim. Pilate had delivered him to be crucified. And yet from the very hour of apparent defeat and death came the world's life and victory. From that very moment of apparent failure came the spirit of the conquering cross. Surely if the cross speaks as all, it says that apparent victory is real, apparent failure is real victory, and that there is a heaven for those who trust and a hell for those who scorn. So I want you to see this morning the difference between the real and what seems. It seemed that Elijah's success was in the shouting on Carmel. His real success was in the quiet obedience of the 7,000 who had taken his God to be their God. The lesson is here. It's for the teacher, for the Sunday school teacher, the Christian school teacher, for the one who works and prepares and illustrates and encourages, and then goes to bed sick at heart because there was no response, no progress. I want you to remember the power of indirect influences. Those that show out of your life, not from an insulated hour in the auditorium or the classroom. There is good done of which we can never know or never hear the when or the where. See, your real success is not in the student's smile, not in the attentive eye, not in the perfect score on a test. It's in that invisible influence that you impressed on character, which only he alone can read who counted the 7,000 nameless ones in Israel. And for you who are here today, what is ministerial success? Crowded churches? Full aisles? Attentive congregations? Praise of the brethren? Big meetings? Elijah thought so. Elijah thought so. And when he found out his mistake and discovered that the applause on Carmel became a hideous stillness, you remember that his heart nearly broke in disappointment. And just remember what that did to the prophets. Brethren, your success lies in altered lives and obedient hearts. In that unseen work that will be recognized and rewarded at the judgment seat of Christ. You say, here I stand and here I will stand. And get below outward appearances. Hollywood and Wall Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, Peyton Manning, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, they measure success by the crowds, by the polls, by the scores, by the millions, by the votes. Work for eternity lies far, far deeper than that. Get below appearances. Get below glitter and show. It was not in the shouting of the crowd on Carmel, but it was in the humble silence of the hearts of the 7,000 that shone the living proof that Elijah had not lived in vain. Got it? Just keep doing what you're doing. Do not be weary in your well-doing. In due time. Father, thanks for your word. I pray that you'd encourage us to keep on keeping on doing what you've commissioned us to do. In Jesus' name, amen.